You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, June 21st, 2011. Happy first day of summer. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Spencer Ackerman of Danger Room, Spackerman, will be giving us a preview of President Obama's address tomorrow on apparently our involvement in war number, one. In Afghanistan, Afghanistan is number one, Iraq number two, Libya three, or Yemen three, Libya four, or Yemen four. Hard to know, but Afghanistan, I think, definitely war number one. We'll be talking to Spackerman later in the program. Also on this program, we will play last week's Jimmy Reefer Cake song and Screaming Majority songs. Because apparently on the podcast on Friday, I was playing them and you can't hear it. So there was a nice little break in there. And I also want to tell you that I can see the statistics of how many people are downloading various podcasts. And many of you, many of you have downloaded the Friday. And only many of you have downloaded the Thursday live from Netroots Nation. I got to tell you, that Thursday, good as gold. I would even say Thursday, better than Friday, arguably. On Thursday, we had Joe Sudbay. We had Gaius Publius from America Blog. We had Chris Bowers. Very interesting. Chris Bowers wrote a great piece in Daily Kos. I'll either get to it today or tomorrow. But you definitely want to check out, we spoke to McJoan. We spoke to her on Friday. On Thursday, we spoke to David Dayan, Amanda Marquette. You definitely want to check out Thursday's podcast. You don't want to miss any of them, frankly. Let's be honest. But you definitely want to check out Thursday's. If you want to miss one, I would say go back. I'm convinced I had one in May that you should miss. If you haven't already missed that one, miss that one in May. I don't remember which one it was. I got this email, folks. And most of the time I read email like this in the member section of the program, available only to Majority Report members. But this one got my goat. Now, maybe I'm just taking the bait here, but it's from listener Deanna. And maybe I should preface this by saying that if I had the ability to isolate IP addresses and prevent a podcast from ever ending up in someone's player, it would be Deanna. And maybe that's a little harsh. Because I have no problem. I get right-wing email all the time, and I welcome them, the opportunity to listen to the podcast. But she writes, there are no networks of oligarchs conspiring to eliminate your social security. This is not Weimar. There are no Nazis. Your conspiracy theories, amidst your otherwise insightful punditry, sync your show. Oh, I should say, wait a second, let me preface this, because it may not make sense without the prefaces. The subject line is why I cannot subscribe. RFK Jr., Kerry One, Bush Stole Ohio, is also a conspiracy theorist. Join reality, Sam. Stop associating yourselves with these fringe liberals. Your voice is needed. There's a place for you in primetime. Stop the madness. Bachman wants Medicare to stick around, albeit in a responsible form, in her mind. She is not a revolutionary who wants to eliminate social programs, and Republicans want to protect Social Security, albeit in a different form. Most congressional Democrats get this. There is no shock doctrine or any other nonsense aspiration to overthrow the government. There will be no, quote, Al-Qaeda sympathizer, infiltrator, lone wolves, quote, in the U.S. Air Force who crash F-16s into the Capitol Dome and wipe out all Democrats during a GOP walkout on April 4th. There will be no military coup or Chilean September 11th. Join the mainstream, Sam, then I can subscribe. Let me work from backwards to forward with this email. And it's also conveniently from batshit crazy to just completely misinformed. I have no idea what you're talking about with an Al-Qaeda lone wolf April 4th. Or military coup, Chilean September 11th. I have absolutely no idea what you're talking about. I'm just going to write that off to your batshit crazy. And had you led with that, I probably wouldn't have read the rest of your email. And I would have completely disregarded this. Oh, wait, let me even back up. Then I can subscribe. Well, I'll get back to that. The notion that there is a shock doctrine, I'm going to just write this off to you don't understand what that is a reference to. That is a reference to Naomi Klein's book about how radical, ideological, economic policies are imposed on a society when there has been some sort of shock to the system. Maybe it's a massive natural disaster. Maybe it's a financial meltdown and a near doubling of the unemployment rate in a matter of months, or massive foreclosures. You probably don't understand what that means. So I'm going to move into the area of your email, which you do think you understand what it means, and which I do think you understand what it means. Bachman wants Medicare to stick around, albeit in a responsible form. What is a responsible form of Medicare? We have a program where every person over the age of 65 in this country is either on Medicare and Medicaid, many of them dual eligible. It is the single most efficient delivery of health insurance that exists in this country. Administrative costs are 3 cents per dollar versus 25 cents per dollar in the private insurance industry. And that industry doesn't even cover these people, which is why they are able to keep it at 25 cents. Because if they had to absorb the oldest and sickest amongst us, their costs would go even higher because they have a massive profit motive. Bachman believes that Medicare is socialism, is communism. It is, in fact, I guess, socialism. But she thinks it's fundamentally wrong. She thinks it's fundamentally against the American principles. She's not a revolutionary who wants to eliminate social programs. She said on stage the other night she wants to eliminate the EPA. When you talk about eliminating Medicare as a government-administered health insurance program and switch it to the Paul Ryan plan, which is we're going to give one quarter of the amount that seniors need to spend on health insurance, and we're going to give them a yearly payment, which they can apply towards health insurance, you are talking about a program that is fundamentally and radically different than Medicare. You can call it Medicare. I can call this show a broadcast TV show. I can call this a musical review. I can say that we're on Broadway. None of that is true. But if there are enough idiots like yourself out there who think that if I call it a Broadway musical, then perhaps your premium subscription wouldn't be 50 cents a day, but rather $75 to $85 to $125 a day based upon what seats you would have for my Broadway show. Republicans want to protect Social Security. That is a joke. That is a joke. We know they tried to privatize it under George Bush. We know that has been the Republican agenda. Deanna, use your Google. First of all, I will go into your preferences and remove all the cachet, because it seems to me that anything you Google will take you to some type of nut job page. Use your Google. Look up the Republican platform, the National Republican platform, in the years following 1935. Those first two. I think it's 36. You will see the disdain they have for Social Security. If you privatize it, if you change it from a defined benefit program, which means that I put money in, that money can change, you can get higher, you can get lower based upon my taxes, based upon the rate going up, but I always know what I'm going to get out, a defined benefit program. They want to change it to a defined contribution program, which means you need to put in a certain amount. There's no guarantee what you get out. That's the same plan they have for Medicare. That is a fundamental difference. As different as a live streaming show on the internet and podcast is from a Broadway musical. Yes, there are people involved. Yes, there is an audience in both instances, but that's about where the similarities end. The idea that Bush stole Ohio is well documented. Now, perhaps the idea of stole, maybe you don't like that word choice, but it is completely documented that the amount of voting stations, the amount of voting mechanisms were purposely and consciously shortchanged in areas of Democratic strongholds. Go back and see the Secretary of State's rejection of new registrations based on the card stock. There's a place for me in prime time. Stop the madness. You are the madness. And if the price for getting on primetime is to not talk about the reality of these programs, then I could give a shit. I'll find some other way to make money. I never said there were networks of oligarchs conspiring to eliminate your Social Security, my Social Security. I don't think there are networks, and maybe they're technically not oligarchs, although I think I've got some reading to do right here. That's not the same book, about the oligarchs. But the fact of the matter is, go listen to what Erskine Bowles and the former Senator Simpson have to say about Social Security. I never said it was Weimar. In fact, I think I'm one of the few voices who don't think that we're headed for a Weimar situation with rampant inflation. That's all on the right. There are no Nazis. There were. there are some neo-Nazis, but they're completely not involved in my conversation. So, Deanna, take your prime time. Take your listening habit. Go somewhere else. Honestly, there are plenty of places for you where you can live in this notion that what we're seeing is simply the responsible people come in and deal with the situation. I suspect you feel you have no need for Social Security. You have no need for Medicare. I suspect you're not terribly worried about the job situation. And that's good. Be well. But do not subscribe. I will not take your subscription. We need subscriptions. But if Deanna Kay signs up for a subscription, it will be canceled. I don't like your attitude. And the one decent thing, and I harp on we need members. We do need members. Every day it is a daily grind. There are certain anxieties that, you know, we have here because we don't know if we'll be able to continue. But I promise you, I will feel much better canceling your subscription just based upon your lunacy than I would in taking, I suppose if you became like a French member. What is French at now? $500 a month? Damn. All right. Yeah. I'll make an exception. If you become a French member, I will take your subscription. Oh, you know what? What's the 250?
It's a professional left now.
No, that's a, well, I'm glad you guys are on the ball.
Super Marxist.
Yes, if you become a super Marxist member, I will take your membership. Hey, anything below that, forget it.
I don't know, I would take a professional leftist too.
Sorry, no. Not worth it. Not worth it. We've got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Spencer Ackerman. Just not interested. There's an anxiety in doing something that this small. It's a small business that I'm trying to launch, get off the ground. We will grow over time with the help of members. But the one big benefit of doing a show in this manner is that I do not have to kowtow to idiots. And I shan't. Good day, madam. Good day. We'll be right back with Spencer Ackerman. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. It is always a pleasure to have Spencer Ackerman, Spackerman, from the Danger Room at Wired on this program. Spencer, how are you?
I'm very well, Sam. The pleasure is all mine, as always.
Someday I'm going to teach you about Google Voice Chat. It is a wonderful application. You are stuck back in the dark ages with your Skype technology.
I know. The kids these days.
That's right. Well, the kids. I mean, frankly, well, let's face it. The kids have moved on. All right. Fair enough.
Sorry, I couldn't hear you. I was using Skype.
So tomorrow, President Obama is going to have a major address, we've been told, on Afghanistan. Wait, is tell me about the timing of this. I mean, my understanding is that this is something that seems to be a little bit ad hoc. Is that the case?
Yeah, it seems to be. We're getting this speech tomorrow because, you know, we're at the dawn of we're at the gates of July 2011, which he said in 2009 would be when withdrawals from Afghanistan would start to happen. This seems like as good a time as any. Indications that I've gotten is that decisions about what this drawdown will actually look like are still TBD. So this is what we get. We'll probably still have wet ink on it.
TBD meaning to be determined.
Indeed.
Okay, there you go. Now, tell me, do you think that there's any... I mean, look, they've known about this promised drawdown for, well, since 2009. Does this have anything to do with what we heard in that first debate and in terms of from the Republicans? I mean, when you have Mitt Romney, who is the at least the presumptive favorite, moving to the left, it seems like, of Obama on Afghanistan, how much is that playing into this?
I think very little. What plays into it much more is the fact that in 2010, after Stanley McChrystal flamed out because of a Rolling Stone profile, Obama picked David Petraeus as his general to run the war. And Petraeus has been saying loudly and often, and I did an interview with him in his office in Kabul last August, in which he made this really clear, he favored as small and as backloaded a drawdown from Afghanistan as possible. And that was a choice that if Obama didn't understand he was getting when he picked Petraeus, although I suspect he did, that's what he got. And now comes the test of making July 2011 somewhat meaningful while still holding true to that basic plan that, you know, Petraeus has been, you know, saying for nearly a year now that he was going to implement.
And so now Petraeus is going to be leaving this position soon, yes?
No. Yes, he's going to he's going to go to the CIA.
And so I don't understand, like, what impact does he have in this if he is leaving this for the CIA, or is there a more omnibus, more macro vision of this? In other words, you know, to what extent will his moving to the CIA play into our involvement in Afghanistan, and to what extent does his imminent departure from his current role implicate all of this?
You know, Petraeus is, you know, among the most influential military figures of his generation. You know, thanks to his role in the Iraq surge, what he's worked on, what the military in Afghanistan has worked on, is backloading the Afghan withdrawal as much as possible to get at least one more year's worth of real combat in. You've heard, you know, another outgoing official, Defense Secretary Robert Gates, make the same case over the last couple of weeks. This is going to be something that his successor, John Allen, his friend, who's going to come in and run the war, you know, we haven't heard what he believes explicitly, but it's really hard to imagine that he would favor, you know, getting the surge troops, you know, all out this year.
So, Petraeus is on record as saying 30,000 by the end of 2012 coming out, correct?
Oh, he's not really on record as saying anything. What we've gotten from the press right now is that, you know, the range of options all kind of stagger out to the idea that 30,000 by the end of 2012 is what's you know, been presented to Obama.
And we should know, we should remind people that right now we have about nearly 100,000 troops in Afghanistan, with another 40-odd thousand NATO troops. So we're still talking about a small amount. But with all that said, your piece, I guess, was it today?
It was this morning. Yeah.
This morning in Danger Room basically says that misses the point.
Yeah, in two important ways. There's the superficial way, and then there's the bigger picture way. The superficial way is that, you know, even if Obama decides get all 30,000 gone, you know, this year, and really do, you know, a really big drawdown in Afghanistan immediately, we'll still have twice the number of troops in Afghanistan, 68,000, is before he came into office. There was a surge of, you know, comparable size in 2009, even before the surge that he announced at West Point. Obama sent 21,000 extra troops into Afghanistan as one of his first acts in office. No matter what, they stay. So even after, if we take the most backloaded impression of the surge, withdrawal going forward, there'll still be 68,000 troops in Afghanistan after 2012. So this is not going to be, you know, a really substantial reduction in forces in Afghanistan, you know, even at the most accelerated of paces. We're talking about until 2014 at least, a really, you know, massive troop commitment. After that, the strategy, you know, the drawdown in Afghanistan isn't hinged to any political strategy that I can understand.
All right, wait, before we get to that, let's I want to put this, those numbers you're talking about in context, because for approximately 6 years, we had half the amount of troops in Afghanistan as we do now. Is that, do I have those numbers right?
Hovering around something like 30 to 35,000.
And
remember,
now,
there was this whole other war.
Right. No. Yes. War number two, if I have my numbers correct. So we actually now have almost three times the amount of troops as we had in Afghanistan from approximately 2002 to 2008.
Yeah.
And so, with that said, before we get to the political calculations and that your piece is really focused on, what is the sense that you get from the reporting you've done, from the visiting you've done? Has the having three times more troops, plus I presume a similarly enlarged NATO presence, or maybe not so much? You can correct me on this. Has that had a significant created a significant change on the ground?
It depends on what you mean by significant, which might be the most dire indictment of the Afghanistan war. Tactically, it really has. The U.S. is in places in southern Afghanistan that it just never was before the war. It cleared out the Argandab River Valley, Helmand Province, Kandahar, you know, the second most populous city in Afghanistan, and pushed the Taliban back in a variety of ways from its spiritual homeland. In the east, you know, the place where, you know, Taliban and the Haqqani network and allies of al-Qaeda, you know, infiltrate in and out of Pakistan, it's not. That was the focus of the war up until 2009, when people saw how badly the South was getting, how badly the South was going, and decided to refocus there. The East, you know, a significant, I'm not sure off the top of my head, but a significant proportion of U.S. casualties are coming from the East, where it doesn't feel like there's been much of a troop surge, and there definitely feels in the East like it's a neglected battle zone for the South. And that leads to the kind of, you know, broader question I think you're asking that my piece tried to address today, is like, what does this all add up to? And the, you know, the real question, you know, gets answered there by just saying, well, what's the political strategy to end the war? You know, how do you make sure that whatever military gains you had, however you, you know, knock the hell out of the Taliban, it doesn't return, it doesn't, you know, consider, you know, persisting as an insurgency? And the answer to that is, only peace talks can settle this. We've now had two different versions before we get to peace talks with the Taliban of what a political strategy was supposed to look like. One, strengthen the government, get Hamid Karzai to govern better. That's failed by any calculation. I don't really see how anyone could argue that point. The second, try and peel off lower level Taliban fighters with, you know, job security, with the prospect of jobs and physical security from the Taliban. You know, really not very many Taliban buy into that. They just haven't, you know, signed up in numbers that the general running that program thinks will be significant. Why not? Because there isn't a comparable effort from the top to get the top level Taliban to lay down their arms and stop fighting, join the government, whatever, come to some kind of terms and modus vivendi that can end the insurgency. Only that matters ultimately for Afghanistan's war, you know, coming to a close. The U.S. can withdraw if it chose to, but if that doesn't happen, Afghanistan could just fall to pieces again. And the question that I'll be looking at when Obama gives his speech is, how is this drawdown and whatever comes after it going to support that broader political objective of the peace deal? And I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, so we had essentially, there were strike number one was, we go in there, we help, if not install, at the very least support the Karzai administration. That was a failure because he just, the political forces are such there, and he maybe as a person and as an administration cannot sort of edify or create some type of political stability in the country. And that vacuum of political stability has led to sort of the creep of Taliban. The second strategy was to buy off the Taliban soldiers, I guess you will, or irregulars, if you want, and that also failed. So now the question is, can we make this political deal with the leadership? To what extent have our tactical gains in the South made that more or less, if at all, possible?
The honest answer is it's hard to know. What the military says is that, and it, you know, it has a certain logic to it. You know, the more you beat them and the more they're run out of their areas that they used to hold, the more they see that the U.S. is going to be remaining in force in Afghanistan, even beyond July 2011, the more hopeless it'll seem for them. On the other hand, analysts have argued that, you know, what the U.S. is inadvertently doing is killing off the guys who have the possibility of making peace, the people you really could negotiate with. The mid-level commanders and higher who are more tied to particular areas. And beyond that, it's difficult to know what the external pressure is on Mullah Omar to make his own peace. You know, I've heard generals argue that killing bin Laden has got to make Omar figure, you know what, the U.S.'s eyes and ears are everywhere. We might as well just, you know, sue for peace or just see what we can get. Out of the U.S. I don't really know how much, you know, evidence there is for that proposition, but, you know, now we have confirmation that at least in some furtive form, negotiations with the Taliban have begun. And right now it would seem like, you know, each side is going to try and test each other's seriousness, find out what the best possible deal is, find out what they can live with, you know, the sort of things that, you know, typically throughout history end wars, you know, a rough, you know, bumpy, difficult process between parties that don't trust one another.
Is it possible that the timing of this address by Obama has more to do with those talks with the Taliban than anything else? I mean, if the idea is that we need to convince them, and because it seems to me that you would be hard-pressed if you were a member of the Taliban, particularly in the leadership, to assume that the U.S. is going to be there forever, although one never knows. And so is Obama coming out now, and this is as much for the consumption of the parties to that talks as it is for any type of domestic pressure? Because I don't get the sense that there is a mounting domestic pressure to get out of Afghanistan. I would like there to be, but if it's not a political pressure, you know, in the sense that Mitt Romney wants to get out, or there is a growing sort of isolationist or, you know, a movement in the Republican Party, then there must be a reason for the timing for this, yes?
I mean, the timing for this is that it's almost July 2011, and Obama has to say what he meant by July 2011. It's a fascinating proposition that, you know, maybe there is some, you know, momentum with Taliban talks that he's going to, you know, pull out of his hat. I haven't heard anything like that. It would be really hopeful if that turns out to be the case. At the same time, you know, when the Pakistanis arrested the number two Taliban official, you know, last year, there was a lot of, you know, hopeful speculation that, like, well, maybe this is him coming to the table with the Pakistanis and he can bring Omar along and the war is going to get wrapped up. I drank that Kool-Aid, you know, like the Kool-Aid man was bursting through my bedroom wall. And, you know, that turned out not really to be true. I don't know. I'd be really curious to hear if he tethers the withdrawal speech at all to a political strategy, particularly a strategy about negotiations. I find that to be a really helpful thing for the strategy. With Obama and Romney, do you really hear much of a difference? You know, what I heard from that debate was, you know, Romney saying he's sick of the war, he wants the war to end, and it's got to happen at a pace that makes sense on the ground. I don't really hear much difference from Obama.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess that's the case. But, I mean, it's sort of within, I guess maybe it's just within the Republican Party to hear a guy like Romney say that. It's more less the difference between Obama and Romney and the difference between Romney and, say, Romney from the classical, the neoconservative movement conservative perspective, which is, you know, we can't show that type of weakness. I mean, I'm looking at Romney basically based because of who Romney is, that he's always on a sliding scale, literally. You know, if he's starting out the debates this way, he's made his position. He only has one direction where he can head into unless he feels the headwinds on that.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's different if you're a Republican, right?
Yeah, it is different if you're a Republican. I mean, you know, in that sense, you know, it gets a lot more attention. These guys have managed to sort of, you know, make a very hasty transition from, you know, this notion of spreading democracy everywhere to we can't afford wars. But I'm curious. I mean, you're telling us that we should keep an eye out for Obama talking about Afghanistan in more political terms, in terms of like what we can do on the ground. But if he is responding, not just simply to this date, which, I mean, of course he has to because the date is coming, but this seems to have been like a fairly hastily called address. If he is responding to some to these talks in some way, that his negotiators are coming out and saying, you must project A, B, or C so that we have more leverage with the Taliban, he could be, we may not hear that notion of politics. Is that possible?
Yeah, that's totally possible. One of the things that the Obama team had as a kind of unintended consequence of announcing the July 2011 date in the first place is that Afghanistan and Pakistan had no idea what to make of that. They thought that when Obama said, you know, we're going in force until July 2011 and then we start getting out, that meant, oh, the U.S. is really going to start to leave in July 2011 and we've got to, you know, hedge our own bets and just figure out what a post-American, you know, future is. And it didn't really redound to the U.S.'s benefit very well. The difference here is that, you know, now he's had to, Obama's, you know, gone through that experience. And so now, you know, he's going to figure that, you know, whatever he says has a domestic audience and it's got an international audience, and the international audience is going to want to hear some kind of reassurance that the U.S. isn't just getting out. You know, Hamid Karzai doesn't really like the United States. He likes not being strung up on a lamppost a lot more.
Right. I mean, I can share that sentiment, at least about the lamppost. Right. Spencer Ackerman from Danger Room at Wired.com. Thank you so much for joining us. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Sam, as always.
And please do not hesitate if you need to some help on downloading that Google Voice application. It's very easy. I just did it with my mom.
I have a VCR that needs fixing as well, if you could come by.
I have an entire instructional DVD that I'm selling on that, but stick around for more information on that. It's not a huge seller, I got to admit. Spencer Ackerman, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sam.
We'll be back in just a moment. Ackerman was giving me grief when I asked him for a landline. He's like, hey, Grandpa. And so that's what the whole Skype Google. We'll come back. We still got a couple of stories. Wow, I got a lot more stories to do. We'll be right back. Should I stay or should I go now? Should I stay or should I go now? All right, folks. File this one in not a big deal, but in some ways a perfect manifestation of my own frustration with the Obama administration. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking to Dahlia Lithwick on the latest Supreme Court ruling and on Clarence Thomas's continuing ethics problem. But the Supreme Court, for me, as I've stated many times, is of paramount importance. As we have seen over the past 6 years, the political power can shift between parties, from Democrats to Republicans to Democrats. Fortunately, the stability comes in the fact that our the network of oligarchs seems to have the same position on a lot of these things. But that aside, the Supreme Court is likely to be the primary motivator for me in the 2012 elections. Secondarily, will be a function of who the fact that Obama will be running against the Republican, just in general. But a story like this is very indicative of my frustration, because I never had what I perceived as wild-eyed notions of what Obama would be able to accomplish legislatively. What I did hold on to was there is an upside that maybe he is that guy who sat in Reverend Wright's pew. Maybe he will be very aggressive on a legislative front. Maybe he will be able to get there. But that was never what I was banking on. I was actually banking on, and much to my lament now, although, again, I've said many times, I don't think there was necessarily a better bet, and I don't know who would be better even now in retrospect of the viable candidates. But when he said that he looked to Ronald Reagan as a positive example, I was hoping that he would do for progressive, liberal, left ideas what Ronald Reagan did for the right. I mean, Ronald Reagan's legacy is that you can cut taxes on the rich, when in fact we know that he raised taxes. His legacy is creating essentially a zombie Reagan, the guy that every Republican would rather vote for than any of the stooges that they're going to vote for. I did a video for 236 back in the 08 primary in New Hampshire. Every single person on the streets of New Hampshire, short of, I think, Ron Paulites, when asked, would you like to vote for the guy that you're holding a sign for, or Ronald Reagan? Ronald Reagan, Ronald Reagan, Ronald Reagan, Ronald Reagan. So when I see a story like this about how last year thousands of youth climate activists called on Reagan and Obama to restore solar power to the White House, which Ronald Reagan removed 20 years ago, more than 25 years ago. Wait, 88, when did he come into office? 80, right? 84. I can't remember. I'm old. Like on day one, when he came into the office, he removed solar panels. 1980. He removed solar panels from the White House, just to make a point. Solar power, that's for fags. We don't do that here. Obama promised via his Secretary of Energy, Stephen Chu, last October, that by the end of this spring, there will be solar panels and a solar hot water heater on the roof of the White House. Now, listen, I understand problems with contractors. It's very difficult to get anybody to come out to your house and do any type of work. All right? I had a problem with my water pressure. I had all sorts of problems like that. Very difficult to get a plumber, to get a contractor to come out to your house. I imagine the White House can do it. And they have missed that deadline that they called for. And now they're saying there's a chance we're going to figure this out in September. It is the hesitancy, the cowardice, the lack of commitment, however you want to characterize this, of the Obama administration to make even symbolic gestures to things that we should all agree upon. Is there anybody in the country who is not simply just picking a team that would have a problem with the White House sort of symbolically showing that solar power is good? That this is something we should be moving in this direction. Yes, I think everybody understands the White House has a capacity to do it easier than anybody else. But how do you decide this is not an important symbolic gesture at this time? It is the political weakness of the Obama administration, which is so frustrating. Had they had only half of their legislative accomplishments, but had been full-throated in taking the generation of people who have entered politics because of Obama and given them a rhetorical framework for a progressive worldview, that would make me far more excited than the idea that we still, than these half measures and these, the complete refusal, it seems, to engage in the marketplace of ideas. The Miss USA contest, it turns out, I don't know, I guess there are 50, I don't know how many contestants there are, but I assume 50, 51, right? I mean, they come from every state. Maybe, I don't know if Guam has a, I don't know how it works. If the protectorates, I don't know. Forgive me. So Miss California won. I don't know what the judging criteria is for this. And look, I don't imagine that Miss USA is full of liberals. I would imagine that it leans towards the right. Because only old, dirty men who are the number one constituency of the Republican Party, I think, probably watch this. I don't know what the demographics are. So Miss California got into the semifinals, and the preliminary judging includes interviews in which she was, I guess she's only one of only two among the 51 contestants to unequivocally support the teaching of evolution. Yes, don't look at me like that, Evan. 49 potential Miss USAs had an issue with supporting the teaching of evolution. That's not, I think both should be, I mean, they don't, the 49 of them have a problem with the teaching of evolution.
That's pathetic.
Then they had other difficult questions like, would you use an online dating service? Most of them said no, apparently. Which apparently, not so much an issue if you're that attractive that you can be in, or that you just are living in this sort of weird bubble where all you care about is pageants anyways. Would you pose for tasteful nude photos? Split vote. Because there's probably a percentage of them that will go on to do that if they don't become Miss USA or Miss California, whatever it is. And they were asked to make the sounds of a cat, a motor, a police siren, and a slot machine, which apparently was painful to watch, particularly for this writer, Kathy Lynn Grossman, in USA Today. One after another of the contestants, like Miss Maryland, confused the evolution of species with the origin of life, which apparently are not the same. Or said a variation of Michigan's line, which is that it's silly and ignorant not to know both sides, including the religious, including religious views in public schools. Three were flat out opposed. Miss Kentucky, Miss Alaska, who assures us that each was individually created by God for a purpose, and Miss Alabama, who doesn't even believe in evolution.
Those three states really aren't a surprise.
Well, but it's the other 46.
It's kind of disappointing that the only ones who it was only, what, Massachusetts and California.
That's right.
I mean, what is the judging panel on this? Do you think they're coached to kind of like?
No, I don't even know if this part was televised. Sunday night on the main stage, the first runner-up, Miss Tennessee, Ashley Durham, was asked if burning religious books is protected by the same First Amendment free speech. This gives you a sense of their. Well, I should say that Campanella, the California, said, I was taught evolution in high school. I do believe in it. I'm a huge science geek. You know what? You don't need to be a huge science geek. You shouldn't be.
They were also touting that she's a big Star Wars fan, so.
Good. Good. But the bottom line is, if the President of the United States will not put solar panels on the White House is afraid to do that. Do you think that some 19-year-old Miss USA contestant should actually forcefully and full-throatedly support the teaching of basic science principles in school? If there is one thing that the president could do, regardless of what the Senate makeup is, regardless of what the House makeup is, regardless of anything, is put solar panels on the White House. Miss Tennessee, Ashley Durham, was asked if burning religious books is protected by the same First Amendment free speech rules that cover burning an American flag. Here's her view of the Constitution. And forgive me, I'm going to assume she has a bad Southern accent that sounds something like, I know that some people view it as a freedom of a speech. She has some Italian ancestry. I know that some people view it as freedom of speech. However, burning the American flag is not patriotic at all. No American citizen should do that, and you should also respect other religions. I'm a Christian and a faithful person. I would personally not appreciate someone burning the Bible, and that's just a line you do not cross. Well, I mean, maybe she's hedging. Maybe she's saying they have a right to do it. I would rather you didn't. Well, that's fine. But the point remains that when Barack Obama does not use, never mind his bully pulpit, doesn't use his own ability to dictate what happens at his house, the White House in this instance, then I think we really have a problem. And I think we really have a problem. Now, with that said, it is now time, ladies and gentlemen, for these week's Reefer Cake songs. Now, wait. We have the Jimmy Reefer Cake song, right? Which was the Cliff Schechter opening.
No, he sent another one. Since we didn't have Cliff Schechter, that's what I pulled. He sent two.
Yes. Okay. So we don't have Cliff Schechter today. We will play that on Friday. Don't Twitter Your Wiener. Is this the same one that he did the week before?
It's loosely based around the same themes.
Jimmy, okay. Well, let's listen to it. Here it is. Don't Twitter Your Wiener. Jimmy Reefer Cake.
We're here live at Netroots Nation here in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I got Jimmy Reefer Cake with me.
Hey, hey.
Jimmy, I understand people have been tweeting their meat.
Yeah, yeah. The song was a big success, but, you know, that wasn't the intent.
Now, hold on a minute here, Jimmy. You were the guy who wrote Twitter Your Wiener.
Come on, you know. Here, I'll write this. This is a public service announcement.
Long ago, my daddy told me, son, don't Twitter your wiener.
Just don't do it, son.
Wise words, especially if your name is actually Wiener.
Yeah, that's his name.
But Wiener twittered his wiener. A stupid politician. Is that a wiener in his pants? Or is he a magician? I know it's fun to show off some nice wood, but don't you Twitter your wiener, man. That can't be good. If you're twittering your wiener, reconsider your position. If someone asks you to do it, reject their proposition.
Well, I thought that was pretty good. I'm so over the wiener thing. Now, granted, to be fair to Jimmy Reefer Cake, this was for last Friday, which I was over it then, too. Musically, gentlemen, do you want to weigh in here?
Musically, it was good. I enjoyed the instrumental portion. The topic, it's kind of like, you know, how, like, the first Saw movie was, like, really good. And then they went ahead and made six more. That sucked. It's time to move on.
I wish I knew more about the Saw movie. I guess it's not a trilogy. What is it? What do you call that when there's seven?
Certainly not a
trilogy. Septology?
double trilogy. That's what I call it.
Double trilogy plus one.
Yeah.
Okay, well, fair enough. Thank you for that submission, Jimmy Reefer Cake. We will play the Cliff Schechter. I think, you know, it could we could be getting a little mired down in Cliff, but we'll definitely play it for Cliff on Friday. I can't promise we're going to keep doing it all the time. But now, ladies and gentlemen, the screaming majority, David Benjoya, and the name of this song is Can You Recall Scooter? This is a Wisconsin song. Great song. Let's hear it.
Snotty Scott Wanker, friend of the banker, class war criminal. Sits in Wisconsin, brings all the cons in, squats on every ride he can find. Folks in Wisconsin can still recall when the government didn't used to screw us all. They can still recall. Call your ass right out of your seat. This summer senator's feeling the heat. This winter scooter will see it repeat. Up like a rat from Badger Democrats. Scooter can't hide his sleeve. The pack and Charles Woodson know they've got the goods on Scott. He cut the cheese heads out of their pension. Thought no one was paying attention. But he don't know Jack from Cheddar. A cheese head ought to know better. Folks in Wisconsin can still recall when the government didn't used to screw us all. They can still recall. Call your ass right out of your seat. Republican senators feeling the heat. That little prick scooter will see it repeat.
CallOutTheVote.com.
I gotta say that I love the sentiment, and you know I also am partial to that type of music.
Yes.
In my advanced age, that type of music I am a big fan of.
Oh, I liked it too.
I really like that.
Well, you guys are getting older.
They had me before the banjo, but the banjo really sealed the deal.
That was excellent. Screaming Majority.
What was that website he shouted out at the end?
That's the only part that
Was it CallOutTheVote.com? It's in the email. Let me look it up.
CallOutTheVote.com? CallOutTheVote.com.
Yep, that's it.
All right. Well, check it out, folks. CallOutTheVote.com. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that is our program for today. Whoa, you freeloaders. You got a full extra, almost 17, 18 minutes. So please, if you can become a member, unless your name is Deanna, please become a member. Deanna, you can become a member, but only a super Marxist or French member.
I still say you open up the liberal.
No. Nothing less than $250 a month. Because it is that important to you. But for the rest of you, 50 cents a day, $10 a month. Keep this show alive, ladies and gentlemen. We need your memberships. You can always support the show through Amazon, our link at Majority FM. Or by buying your coffee from justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY in the coupon box. Get 10% off fair trade coffee, tea, chocolate. Do it, but please, if you can become a member, we really do need your memberships. If you're just joining us over the past couple of days, take a week or two. See if you love the show. If you do, support it. All right, we will see you on the flip side. You can IM me at Majority FM. We'll be right back.